Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 25th of September. Yesterday, President Obama spoke before the UN General Assembly saying the American military would work with allies to dismantle the Islamic State's network of death. On Tuesday, he for the first time mentioned the terror cell Khorasan Group, which American officials said had a terror plot aimed at the West. We have much to talk about this hour. Why haven't we heard about this Khorasan Group before? How much help are the allies giving? If airstrikes alone aren't enough to destroy ISIS and Khorasan, who would follow through on the ground? And what exactly will destroy the Islamic State? The president also spoke yesterday directly to Muslim youth, saying, "You come from a great tradition that stands for education, not ignorance, innovation, not destruction, the dignity of life, not murder. Those who call you away from this path are betraying this tradition, not defending it." We'll have two guests with us during the course of this hour, and we'll be welcoming your phone calls as well. Jennifer Bendry is joining us at the top of the show, has been a White House and congressional reporter for the Huffington Post for several years and has been covering the conflict with ISIS for the Huffington Post. Later on during the hour, Stephen Simon will join us, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, who previously served as senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House from 2011 through 2012. For you to join the conversation, the phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And we thank you very much, Jennifer, for joining us. Hi.
Hello.
Hi. Thank you for being with us. Yesterday, the president spoke, and you wrote about this, before the United Nations, appealing to the global community, asking the world to help destroy ISIS. How has the world responded, Jennifer?
Well, as the White House is happy to tell people all the time, there are about 40 countries that have signed on and support in some capacity to help with the United States to try to dismantle and destroy ISIS. And on top of that, the U.S. has had five Arab coalition partners that have been actively playing some role in this latest round of airstrikes in Syria. Mm-hmm. So the White House has really been pushing the narrative here that the U.S. is not doing this alone. We've got Arab partners helping to drop bombs in Syria, and we've got broader international support for the cause. So there's some support out there for what's happening. It's just unclear where it's going.
Mm-hmm. And what about support on Capitol Hill? What about congressional support?
Well, that's arguably the most remarkable piece of all of this. Congress has been completely complicit in everything that is going on, with almost no pushback on the need for a congressional authorization on this. There's been no war authorization vote for the president to go in and drop bombs in Syria. And you've got the Democratic and the Republican leaders in the House and the Senate all lined up supporting what the president's doing. Congress actually chose to adjourn for 2 months, about a week ago, to go back home and let lawmakers focus on their reelection campaigns instead of having a debate over a war authorization vote. So the reality is that people in Congress really don't want to talk about this. They want the president to take the lead. If something goes wrong, they can blame it on the president. If something doesn't go wrong, they can say they were with the president the whole way.
And you suggested yesterday in your piece that lawmakers have calculated that it's best to look tough in the face of terrorism as elections approach.
Absolutely. I mean, we've got the elections in about a month and a half. Nobody wants to, well, there's maybe a handful of members out of 535 members of Congress who are out there saying we should not have left Washington. We should have stayed there and voted to authorize what we're doing. It's the role of Congress to authorize war. But nobody wants to, you know, in large part, people don't want to risk having a thorny vote ahead of an election. So they decided to go home. And now you're going to start hearing people say, while they're home, hey, we should have done that, but we didn't. So now we're home, and let's just see what the president does.
Mm-hmm. And certainly the public support for such action went up from the poll last week showing that the vast majority of Americans are in favor of this. I guess you would have to be hopeful that there would be some noticeable good that came from all of this, or public opinion could be pretty fickle, right?
Yeah, I think for the moment, Washington leaders are just watching. They're watching to see what Obama is going to do. They're watching to see what he's doing and quietly but firmly lining up in support behind him, because nobody really knows where this is going. And this is one of the most bipartisan moments that this Congress has seen in 2 years of this congressional session.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody is just lined up supporting what the president's doing, but not taking much initiative on their own to have a voice in whether, you know, on the parameters of this, on authorizing war, on saying this is how long that you can continue doing this, Mr. President. This is how much money you can spend. These are the parameters you have to have in what you're doing, because without that, it's unclear what the costs are and how long this will go on for.
You would imagine, and I don't know if this is the case or not, that most Americans would welcome a discussion of just those very issues in Congress. It is certainly a major thing that we're doing in the Middle East now. We're hearing about new terror groups. All of a sudden, our threat level has been heightened in the last week. You would think that we would want a full-ranging discussion by those who represent us in Congress on all of these issues.
Well, as one congresswoman told me, as lawmakers were running out the door last week to catch their planes to go back home for 2 months, this congresswoman said, well, the reality is elections trump national security around here. And it was sort of sad, and she was slightly joking, but it's the truth. I mean, they, for the most part, members of Congress do not want to debate this issue right now. They don't want to have a vote on it. They don't want to go up against what the president is doing in any way, because nobody really knows where it's going. It's a month and a half before elections. And in the end, individual lawmakers are looking out for their own reelection races.
You talk about a day that was packed with press availabilities and administration officials had answers. And I'd like for you to tell us what the answers were, starting with, have any civilians been harmed?
Thus far, U.S. military leaders say that they don't know, they don't have any signs that civilians have been killed.
Did the U.S. give advance notice to the Syrian government?
That's sort of a curious question, because the administration insists that the United States did not give any notice, is not collaborating with the Syrian government. However, it does look like there was some kind of communication going on there where the United States notified Syria that there would be airstrikes. It's just that there wasn't a time frame put on it.
And how the military action is different from the past 13 years of war?
The main distinguishing factor that you will continue to hear from the president and U.S. military leaders is that there are no U.S. ground troops. So that's the main distinction that you're going to keep hearing. But that also raises questions, because what are the people that we're sending in who are from the U.S. who are being called advisors on the ground, helping with other, say, Syrian rebels, or working with other people on the ground to line up combat? Are those people not considered combat troops? Are they, you know, what about if a U.S. plane that is, you know, launching strikes at certain places in Syria, what if the plane goes down? Would we not send in U.S. combat troops to go in and retrieve the pilot and everybody on board? Those are the kinds of questions that you haven't really heard clear answers on at this point.
Mm-hmm. And what about no mention of this group until Tuesday of this week? And all of a sudden we're getting news reports. This is the most dangerous time we've faced since 9/11. Our alert level should be very high. This Khorasan group, which not too many people had heard very much at all about in press reports, I can't recall this group coming forward. Why now? Where did they come from?
That's a good question. You know, it felt like the argument that the administration is making is, hey, we're already going into Syria and we're already going to be launching terror strikes or airstrikes on this terrorist group that we've all been talking about, ISIS. But hey, since we're here already, we're also going to go ahead and launch strikes on this other terrorist group that is more is closer to posing a direct threat to the United States than ISIS. So that was sort of an aside that was mentioned, as the main focus has been on ISIS. So that was, I've never heard of the Khorasan group. I don't think most people in Washington who cover politics had heard of them. So that was sort of this, I don't know. I'm not sure where that came from. It just seemed like while we're in Syria, we might as well go ahead and bomb this other group that is a threat.
And what about how many other groups there may be? I was listening to Richard Engel, who I think is doing good reporting from this part of the world, and he said there are all kinds of groups like this in Syria.
That's right. There's different factions of groups that maybe some were offshoots of Al-Qaeda or some branch of a different terrorist group that have slightly different goals and what they want to achieve. But, I mean, it just seems like such a complicated situation that we're getting ourselves into. And to be going after ISIS, a terrorist group that is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda but not associated with Al-Qaeda anymore, and it's a group that doesn't have a defined region. It's not based in one country. It's just in different parts of different countries. It's just a very complicated situation, which is why there are questions to be answered about where this is going and what the end game is.
So as you are covering all of this in Washington, it is a democracy. Are there any people in Washington who are in positions of power who are asking the very questions that need to be asked here, or is everybody just going along with the program?
Well, keep in mind that the halls of Congress are empty right now. They cleared out last week, and they will be empty until mid-November.
Right.
There's nobody coming back. So it is literally empty. But the mentality around here is, by and large, you know, 90% of Congress, maybe 95% of Congress, they are just in lockstep. Members of Congress are issuing statements in support of what the president is doing with launching more strikes in Syria. There's a handful of members saying, what are we doing? We didn't even have a war authorization vote. We don't even know what we're getting ourselves into. There's no price tag on what we're getting ourselves into. There's no time limit on it. And we don't even know if this is legal constitutionally. So we should probably come back to Washington and have that debate in public and have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
But the reality is they are most likely not going to come back until mid-November. So they're just going to watch the president and let him do what he's doing and then see how it plays out before they decide how much of a role they want to have in shaping what we're doing.
You mentioned that there are several members of Congress who are urging the leadership to call the chambers back into session. You mentioned Senator Tim Kaine, Democrat from Virginia. Are there other people? Are there a lot of people who are calling for the chamber to come back in session, Jennifer?
No, there's a handful. And to be honest, I suspect some of them might publicly be demanding that Congress comes back to have this debate and vote. But some of those same people are likely privately talking to their party leaders saying, you know what, we can't do this right now. We've got to focus on our elections. I don't want this to screw up my close race. So just don't call us back, even though we're out there publicly saying we should probably come back.
Mm-hmm.
They really don't want to come back.
This has to be an extremely difficult story to be covering because you really don't know what's next, do you?
I don't know what's next, but I don't think anybody knows what's next. So it's not like, as reporters, that we feel like people aren't telling us the plan. I think the plan is evolving militarily and through the White House. So, I mean, the best we can do is tell, you know, report stories to keep the public informed on what's happening day by day. There were more airstrikes today in Iraq and Syria. We are now up to 190 airstrikes in Iraq and 16 in Syria. I mean, we can follow the little pieces that change every day, but where it's going, every day that goes by, it becomes more unclear because there hasn't even been much of a report yet on how successful has it been what we're doing. I mean, it's still early,
right?
And it sounds like this could go on for quite a while.
Right. And what about the stories concerning Khorasan and their being able to have the technology if they don't already have it to blow up a flight in midair? We're hearing that these are the most dangerous days we've faced since 2001. Where is that information coming from, and how do you check the accuracy of that?
I think you have to be a little cautious when people make comparisons to what's going on right now, to the most dangerous threat since 9/11. I say that because that's exactly what some members of Congress have been saying about ISIS, verbatim, that this is the biggest threat since September 11th. Yet you've got the nation's, you've got the Homeland Security Secretary, you've got the CIA, you've got different levels of intelligence agencies saying on record, yes, ISIS is a threat to U.S. interests, but they are not an imminent threat to the United States homeland. And that's a key distinction, because that's usually what we use to decide when we go to war, is if something is a direct threat to the United States. And currently, it's very unclear that they are. You've got, again, the nation's top intelligence people saying there is not an imminent threat, though nobody would dispute that ISIS is a threat to our interests overseas. So when you've got people saying now this new group, Khorasan, is the biggest threat since 9/11, if you read the words closely on what has been said about them, the words were that the group is imminently planning on something that could be an imminent threat.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a slight word choice there that makes it sound as if maybe this group is close to a plan that could later become an imminent threat. I mean, the word choice is very important here, and I would just urge caution before anybody really can say that a group is the biggest threat to the U.S. homeland since 9/11.
And who do you go to as a reporter for intelligence information that you can trust?
You have to talk to a few sources. You go to the Department of Homeland Security, talk to the spokespeople over there, listen to what military leaders are saying, listen to what the CIA is saying, listen to what the National Security Council says, listen to what the White House says, and you kind of look at it all together and see what is tying it all together. And that is where you can get your best sense of where we are.
Mm. Jennifer, thanks. I hope we can touch base with you down the road. Thank you for being with us.
Anytime.
Jennifer Bendry, White House and congressional reporter for The Huffington Post, has been covering the conflict with ISIS for The Huffington Post. We're going to change guests and invite you to join the conversation as we carry on here. Stephen Simon will be joining us momentarily. The question, well, there are so many questions here. Do you think that we need a full-fledged debate about what our actions are now in Syria and in Iraq, what this coalition is, what our plans are to destroy ISIS and Khorasan? Are there many other such groups? Will there be a need for U.S. ground troops? What about the troops who will be on the ground, Kurdish troops and others? Are they ready? Are they up to the task here? Do you think that, as somebody said, maybe facetiously, probably there's a lot of truth in this, that elections seem to be trumping national security? So members of Congress are home campaigning during a time when perhaps they ought to be considering a pretty serious issue. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now. Email, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Stephen Simon is our guest now, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. He previously served as senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House from 2011 through 2012. He's a visiting professor at Dartmouth College and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. Stephen Simon, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our previous guest was talking to a member of Congress who perhaps facetiously, perhaps very truthfully, said that elections seem to be trumping national security. Congress is gone. They're at home. We've got all these big things happening in the Middle East, and Congress isn't there to get all the details and to have a full-fledged discussion about this. Should they?
Well, I think a debate about our interests is in order, because you can't really have a debate about what it is you're going to do militarily or in other respects until you have a sense of what's at stake. And once you have a sense of what's at stake, you can decide how much you want to pay to protect your stake. So a discussion of interests would be, I think, useful. Whether that discussion can usefully be had, in Congress is another story. I'm not so sure that Congress is ready to have such a debate. And I think, their unwillingness or unpreparedness at this point to stay in Washington to really grapple with these issues is, quite understandable because, if you're an elected official, elections are existential.
Right.
So, it's understandable.
Yeah. So how would you answer the question, what is at stake?
Well, my instinct here is that the U.S. interests are present, but limited in scope. They're not unconfined and certainly not existential. In Iraq, we have a serious interest in first because it's an important source of oil, and the oil markets are important, and ISIS is operating in areas of Iraq that are proximate to one of the major areas in which oil is from which oil is lifted. So that's got to be a factor in our thinking. We do have something of an investment in Iraq. We spent a great deal of blood and treasure trying to remake that country. Whether or not we should have done so is a separate conversation. But the fact is, we have done so. There we are. And do we want to protect that investment and keep that country on a relatively stable trajectory, even recognizing that, in the near to medium term, some part of that country is going to be out of the control of the government in Baghdad. And I think to that extent, the program the president outlined is pretty much commensurate with the interest that the U.S. has there.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an unlimited intervention. It's limited, it's limited in a way that's, I think, proportional to the limits on our interest in that country. Syria is maybe a bit of a different story. The administration's rationale for crossing over into Syria is that its enemy in Iraq, ISIS, doesn't respect borders, and therefore, it's not incumbent on us to respect them either. There's a military logic behind this. I mean, in that if you're fighting a sanctuary in one country that has, if you're fighting an enemy, an insurrection, an insurgency in one country that enjoys unfettered sanctuary in a second country, you're really going to have a hard time defeating that insurgency unless you deprive them of their safe haven across the border. So that was, from a military perspective, virtually certain to generate airstrikes on the Syrian side of the border. That they've gone as far west as they have, that is to say, to the essentially the center of Iraq, in addition to installations that are just sort of on the other side of the border from Iraq, is a bit of a surprise. But the administration has obviously calculated that they need to strike ISIS concentrations that lend a degree of credibility to the mission objective that the president sketched out, which is to destroy the organization.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of oil, we were hearing these reports that they're getting oil and selling it for millions of dollars a day. Who's buying all of this oil, and where are they getting this oil, and is that indeed the way they're funding their operations?
Well, they probably get some money, from oil liftings. I mean, there's a fairly large market out there of, I guess you might call it rogue oil. Oil that's not controlled by governments, that's essentially smuggled and onto boats. And, these oil-carrying vessels take them to ports where, buyers will avail themselves of the opportunity to get discounted fuel that they can then resell. I think the sources of income, for ISIS are broader than that, though. They have income from kidnappings, ransom income, and they get donations from, people in the region who have money and who think that these guys are on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about their numbers. Are they people are worried that with our actions, we're going to get more people into ISIS and various insurgent groups because of the nature of our actions. Is there truth in that? Is this group huge and we're just going to have a really hard time getting rid of them? And do we fuel their numbers by our actions?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. The number of fighters is, open to dispute because nobody really knows how many there are. The key number is how many core ISIS people there are in the larger group. So there's a large number that's been put forward now. It's a range, but at the upper end of the range is 31,500 fighters, which I suppose sounds like a lot. I don't really think it's all that big. But the question is, how many of those 31,000 are actually core ISIS people? Now, I think you'd have to count among them the 5,000 to 7,000 foreign fighters that are thought to have converged on Syria and joined ISIS. I think you'd have to say those are true believers and they're part of the core. And you've probably got an equivalent number of Syrians and Iraqis who are part of that core. So let's say, your core is somewhere between, 10, 15,000. And then you've got a lot of hangers-ons. Other groups that see advantage in hitching their wagon to ISIS's star. ISIS is resorts rich. They're on a roll. They've got tremendous momentum. They look like a winner. So you might decide, well, I'll fly the ISIS flag for the time being.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me. These groups include a very wide variety of unlikely bedfellows, Naqshbandi Sufis, Ba'athist dead enders, freebooters, other sorts of religious maniacs, extortionists, thrill seekers. I mean, it's not a very natural, coalition. You're not talking about NATO here.
Right. I'm sure you're not.
No. So the numbers are large. But, if you compare those numbers, for example, to the numbers of the Iraqi army, which everyone concedes is not up to the task right now of taking on ISIS, then the ISIS numbers look pretty puny. The Iraqis have an enormous army. And if it's true that, according to the Pentagon, about a third to a half of the army is salvageable, in other words, with U.S. training and guidance and so forth, they can be turned into useful fighting formations, then, ISIS is going to have its hands full. It's just going to get swamped in Iraq. But again, in Syria, of course, things are more complicated.
Well, and one final question from me about Syria, and then we'll go to phone calls. We keep talking about these moderates forces that we are going to support because, another part of this is getting rid of Assad, I guess, and having that create some stability in the region. But I have yet to ask anybody who can give me an answer, a complete answer, but I'll bet you can. Who are these moderate forces we're supporting in Syria?
Well, there are moderate, I guess what you'd call moderate command structures that do exist, with which the U.S. And other countries have been in contact with for a while. They have never really commanded large forces on the ground. And they haven't been able to pull together the kind of organizational achievement that the more extreme groups have been able to do. One of the reasons that the United States Arm and Train mission took so long to get off the ground and will take even longer now that it's finally been initiated, I guess, although it's not funded yet, is because finding the right people is not easy because mm-hmm. there are not all that many of them. And it's not clear if you're handing out money, guns, and training, exactly who is signing up
right.
for what you're giving away. So the U.S. in particular has a strong interest in knowing exactly who these people are, which is one reason why the throughput, that is to say, the number of fighters that the U.S. thinks it can actually train over the course of the year, the coming year, is so small. It's about 5,400 people, obviously not enough to make a decisive difference on the battlefield in the near to medium term. But that's as many as the U.S. thinks it can reasonably have confidence in, you know, really know who these people are and have confidence that when they get back into Iraq, when they get back into Syria, rather, they're going to go after ISIS and they're going to defend themselves adequately against the regime while they're doing that.
Let's welcome phone calls. Stephen Simon is our guest this part of the show, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, previously senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House from 2011 to 2012. We're talking about the airstrikes and we're talking about the coalition and how strong that may be with Arab nations. We're talking about what our end game is. We're talking about the composition of ISIS. We have yet to talk about Khorasan with this particular guest. We're talking about Congress going home and not taking on a debate about what our policy is. Do you think that that's important to have that debate? Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. And we start with Mohammed in Milwaukee. Hi, Mohammed.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I think the notion of justice must be considered here because ultimately who is just and fair, who is going to be the one who is prevailing. And also I'd like to have a follow-up if that's all possible. Now, that area is void of power, and the avoidance of power, the vacuum of power, has resulted from the onslaught on this area by the Western powers. We debauched the army in Iraq, and this is just a byproduct of what's going on. The Muslim people, I'd like to make this clear to the American populace, because I'm also an American citizen, and I have a good vantage of point of view. Muslims want to be reunited under a caliphate. There is no question about that. This guy, al-Baghdadi, he is a man who has preemptively stolen the momentum of the Muslim Ummah to reunite through the caliphate and put it in the most vicious way. He is the other face of the coin of Bashar. Just 1 year ago, we saw Bashar, who is slaughtering people with a chemical. He also has raped. He has done exactly like Baghdadi is doing. Now we are helping Bashar, in this way. So let me ask the guest, have you heard of a group called Hizb al-Tahrir? Tahrir is a group since 1953 working peacefully. It has hundreds and millions of followers to reunite peacefully, politically, the Muslim people, so that there will be no longer a vacuum of power.
Stephen, have you heard of that
yes.
group?
Hizb al-Tahrir, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. It's a transnational group. It exists in actually many, many countries. Their touchstone is the restoration of the caliphate. And I think there's some truth to the callers, to Mohammed's remark concerning the attractiveness of this concept to many Muslims, particularly to Arabs. I think it probably applies, somewhat more more fully. But they would like to see an Arab world where borders were erased and all Arabs were together in a single country that would presumably wield a lot more clout than the many countries that now make up the Arab world, because they would act as a unified body, as a unified population. They'd have a single government, and the resources that at present are located only in some parts of the Arab world, but not all of them, would be accessible to all Arabs. And, of course, at the top of the list would be the oil that's mainly located in the Persian Gulf and Iraq, and that's a very nice dream. But as a practical matter, it was Arab nationalism that killed the caliphate in 1923 when it finally passed into history. And nationalism killed it because ultimately you had all these leaderships and populations in the different states that emerged from World War One that kind of liked it that way. They liked running their own turf, and they didn't want to subordinate themselves to another empire, whether it was run by an Ottoman caliph or the King of England. They just that wasn't what they wanted at the time. So yes, it's an attractive vision, like other things about the ISIS or the jihadi worldview, because there are many people in the region who are just disgusted with the way things have gone over the past decades. They're disgusted with the poverty. They feel humiliated by events and by outside powers. They're sick and tired of the corruption and the crumbling infrastructures they need to deal with, the lack of employment. They're sick and tired of a lot of things. And here you have, a group that comes along and says, well, there's a fix for all this. And it's a fix that brings us unity, and it brings us justice, and it brings us peace. It brings us to a new utopian dispensation. But, of course, we need to kill our way there.
Yeah, that's the thing, and that's hard to take.
You can't have the new order without destroying the old one.
Right. Thanks, Mohammed, very much for your call. Let's go to Jim in Toma. Hi, Jim. Jim, are you there? Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't press the right button. My fault.
Hello?
Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I wanted to ask, in light of the utter savagery of this ISIS beheading people and burying people alive and crucifying people, what I was wondering is when Americans go to join this organization, which, I use that term loosely, when they go to join them, why can't they be immediately arrested for participating with such a savage organization? And my second part of the question is, we have found from many military advisors that it's going to take years to train the, Syrian ragtag group that would be, fighting against ISIS. Why can't we use our officers to train the Kurds and the other groups that are much more equipped to deal with this barbaric organization?
Thank you, Jim. Stephen.
Well, I think, within Iraq, the United States has facilitated a flow of weapons from other countries to the Kurds in Iraq. It's a tricky situation, though, because, Kurdistan, that part of, Iraq, is part of Iraq. And one of the reasons why the United States is now, intervening in against ISIS in Iraq is precisely because the United States is committed to the existence of the Iraqi state as a unitary state, and not Kurdistan, and not Jihadistan, and not a Shia South, but one coherent, cohesive, unified Iraq. So if the United States were to say to the Kurds in the north of Iraq, okay, we're going to help you build up your army, and we're going to do all this independent of the wishes of Baghdad, of the central government in Baghdad, well, the U.S. would, in a sense, be getting on the side of those who think that the Kurds should secede from Iraq and create their own country. And it's not something the United States is right now is prepared to do diplomatically, certainly, or with respect to, the wishes in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm. Stephen, a question I've wondered for some time, how much money and armed support have we given actually to rebel forces? And if so, who those forces are that has subsequently been used to fire on us?
Well, the program of of supporting the rebels, the armed opposition, until now has been a covert program run by the CIA, or so it's been reported. That being the case, we would be unlikely to know exactly what was spent to do this. My sense is that the program has been on a kind of a small scale, but again, I don't know. One of the reasons that, you know, advocates of moving the program from the covert domain and the ownership, so to speak, of the CIA to the Pentagon was to be able to scale it up. People felt that as long as it was a covert program, it would have to be small. Something big was called for. Therefore, this had to be handed off to the Pentagon to manage, because then, you know, you could have, you know, appropriations for the program that were out in the open. They could be fairly sizable. And $500 million, I think, counts as sizable under these circumstances. So this shift was made. You know, from here on in, we will know how much is spent, because it's they're appropriated funds, and they're not, you know, they're not covert. So we'll know what they are. For the moment, it's $500 million. We'll see how long it takes them to spend that out.
Right. Stephen Simon is our guest this part of the program, and we're welcoming phone calls. One line is open if you'd like to join our conversation about what it is we're doing and with whom in Syria and Iraq to counter the threat of ISIS and Khorasan. We have yet to talk to our guest about that group. Stephen Simon is senior fellow at the Middle East Institute. He was senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House from 2011 through 2012, visiting professor now at Dartmouth College and co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Craig in Kenosha, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Craig.
How are you?
Okay, how are you?
Okay, little annoyed.
Annoyed?
Yes,
all right.
We had one of your callers who talked about it being okay for the United States Congress to do what they're doing because, after all, elections are existential. The existentialism of being elected just ensures that they're going to get paid. I want them to stay in Washington and do what they're getting paid for. It's okay to get paid if you're doing the job for which you're being paid.
I see your point. I think there should be a full-fledged conversation about this as well, Stephen Simon. It's fairly important. It's important. And I understand they want to be reelected, but isn't this an issue that, you know, take at least a couple weeks and don't campaign and talk about all of the ramifications of what we're doing?
Well, you know, ironically, I'm not an expert on American politics, but, you know, I sense that this is just the normal rhythm of things. And when you have a situation like we have now, and what the Huffington Post reporter you were speaking to earlier was saying, where there's a lot of mixed information coming out of Washington on the nature of the threat, I think that robs the issue of some of its urgency, and might, you know, make you know, a legislator feel, well, you know, maybe I really don't have to be there for this right now. It's not that urgent. The issue will be there when I come back after elections, which, you know, after all, are just less than a couple of months away. So, you know, why don't I just worry about what I have to worry about right now, my election campaign, and not worry about a threat that even officials in Washington can't seem to can't seem to agree upon. Now, I'm giving them the benefit of the doubt here, but perhaps, you know, that's how I would look at it if I were one of them.
And yet, on the press yesterday, we're getting all this information, and evidently we bombed their headquarters about this Corazon group, and they're the immediate threat to the United States, and we're all in danger, just as we were in 2001, raising the fear level, I'm sure, among many Americans. And where did all that come from?
Yeah, I have to confess I'm mystified by it myself. You know, there was a poll the other day. Well, it was earlier this week, maybe, an ABC news poll, which had the actual numbers on how Americans felt nowadays about their personal safety, you know, and security. As you were remarking before in your earlier conversation, you know, Americans think that they've never been more unsafe since 9/11. And you know, as a practical matter, that seems you know, really bizarre, because we are a lot safer than we've been probably at any time since 9/11. It's been more than 10 years since we've set up the Department of Homeland Security. We've poured billions of dollars into that organization.
Yes.
We've recreated the defense of our borders, which are much more secure. Coordination between law enforcement and intelligence, you know, U.S. domestic law enforcement and our overseas intelligence has never been better. I mean, we're just, you know, in relatively good shape. Not that, you know, we can't be attacked or a malefactor could not get through. Of course, you know, someone could. But by and large, we're much safer. And when you look at what the officials, the U.S. officials, who are actually in charge of counterterrorism and homeland security responsibilities on a day-to-day basis have been saying, it's really to downplay the ISIS threat to the United States, you know, to the homeland, because after all, ISIS is not structured as a terrorist organization. They don't have a wide web of, you know, underground cells, so far as anybody knows, certainly in the U.S., and probably even in Europe. You know, radicals from those countries are really interested in leaving their home countries and going to Syria to fight with this group, not to stay behind in their home countries and carry out terrorist attacks on behalf of the group. I mean, this ISIS is an army. Now, Khorasan is a bit of a different story. It's part of Al-Qaeda. And Al-Qaeda, just about from its outset, was a terrorist organization. That is to say, not an army that used terrorist tactics, but rather a terrorist organization. And what they were about was attacking the far enemy. That is to say, not the guy next door, which ISIS is doing,
right,
but to attack the United States and its allies. So, you know, they are something of a bigger threat, even though there is some disagreement, as you yourself noted, leaking out of Washington regarding just what imminent means in this case, in terms of the imminent attack. So anyway, to make a long story, a painfully long story short, you know, Americans seem to be really, really uptight, but not for really good reasons. And I can only surmise that it's because, you know, certain individuals, some in the government, like the Secretary of Defense, and for a while the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, spoke about this group in ISIS in very extreme terms as a threat. And the political opposition to the president did so as well, because it was a way to show that the president was inattentive, allegedly inattentive to threats to American interests. And then, you know, there's the media to broadcast, you know, all this. So you have a kind of, you know, you have a panicky American population, which, you know, has a large plurality of which now 40% or 38% or something actually favor boots on the ground. You know, all that very, very surprising given the actual circumstances.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Stephen, for being with us. Stephen Simon, our guest, this part of the program. I'm sorry we didn't get to all of your calls, but sometimes what we need to talk about takes some time because it's not, it's complicated. Stephen Simon is senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, previously served as senior director for Middle Eastern and North African Affairs at the White House. Currently is a visiting professor at Dartmouth College, co-author of The Age of Sacred Terror. And we thank Jennifer Bendry, White House and congressional reporter for The Huffington Post, covering the conflict with ISIS for The Huffington Post with us earlier in the hour. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson and K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. And thanks to Scott Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee.